Ape Pen Publishing continues to sponsor the Above the Firehouse podcast. For classic Disney photography, artwork, and artists, go to www.apepenpublishing.com.
Your attention, please. The Extinct Attractions Club and Above the Firehouse are pleased to present the Disneyland Railroad DVD event.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Extinct Attractions podcast. I am Tony, your host from AboveTheFirehouse.com podcast. We're here down here at the Holiday Inn in Anaheim, California for the train event. It is June 2nd. Yes, indeed, as you can hear, there's a lot going on in the background. We're about to start off shortly with Mr. Dave O'Neill. Thank you guys for listening. Hope you guys enjoy the event. A lot of people are here, so we're going to turn it over. We've got Mr. Brian Summer, your announcer. We're going to kick it off here for you guys.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, put your hands together and welcome the director of today's event, David O'Neill.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the train event here. This is to celebrate our new DVD, the Disneyland Railroad Story, that is produced with myself and Carlene. And the event, the way it goes, if you're used to sitting in a regular event, someone will come up and talk at you for a long time, and it gets kind of boring, and then it's over, and then you're glad it's over. This DVD is a little bit different because we do it as a show where we have a big screen. We get to bring people up that are in our DVD that are here in the audience. We ask them questions kind of like we're interviewing them live, so they don't have to have anything prepared, and they're not going to talk at you. You get to ask questions, and we get to watch a lot of rare film. And so if we start, stop, it's all part of the show. If we take another take, if Brian never flubs a word, but it happened. It's okay. It's all part of the show. So I just want to introduce who's here today, and then we're going to take it over to Brian. So I'm kind of more in the background, like a director along with Carlene. So Carlene will be up here as well. Anyhow, today we've got a band called Desert Sage. We've got our cameraman Chris on our camera back here. We've got Tony podcasting live to the world here on Tony's podcast, Above the Firehouse. We have our scriptwriter, Nathan, right here, Nathan Eek, right here, stand up, Nathan. Lots of research done on the railroad. And then we have members of Carrollwood, so we want to welcome everyone from Carrollwood out today. Finally, we have Mr. Brian Summer narrating the show.
All right, Brian!
So, Brian, we're going to get started here. You're going to take the first part of the script here, Brian number one, and I'll play, and we'll give you a countdown. And if the band wants to play anything during this, that's totally cool. Okay, Brian, ready? And three, two, one.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the Magic Makers, in conjunction with Ape Pen Publishing and the Extinct Attractions, welcome you to the Disneyland Railroad Tribute Event. We're coming to you live from the Golden Nugget Room of the Holiday Inn, here in beautiful Anaheim, California. America's history was shaped by technological advances, the incandescent light bulb, the automobile, the radio, and many others. These discoveries brought forth progress and reflected the innovative spirit of the American people. There seemed to be no limit to America's far-reaching horizons. But throughout the 1800s, no vehicle better personified progress than the steam locomotive. Steam trains were used for everything from transporting goods and people to serving as bully pulpits for politicians. Trains captured the imagination of the American public and reflected the true pioneering spirit of the growing nation. It was the steam train that united the East and West Coast with the first transcontinental railroad in 1869. Americans could now travel across the country in a matter of days and go as far as their spirit would take them. One American that was captured by the majesty of the trains was a Midwestern farm boy named Walt Disney. A self-described cornball, Walt changed the face of family entertainment during the 20th century with countless technological innovations and his creative genius. But throughout all that, Walt always carried a torch for the railroad. When his Disneyland theme park opened, Walt built his own railroad and carried guests off to fun-filled adventures, just as the train did for him so many years before. The Disneyland Railroad represented Walt's fondness for his days gone by, his days filled with excitement, mystery, and idealism. And he shared his fascination with the guests of Disneyland. In a world with the internet, cell phones, monorails, and buses, people still line up to experience a ride on a live steam engine. The Disneyland trains have covered a lot of track in their over 50 years of existence. The railroad's history is a journey in itself. So, if you're ready, climb aboard as we present the story of the Disneyland Railroad. And now, we're happy to bring to the stage our co-director for today's special event, Carlene Fee.
Okay, get me some slack here.
Hello.
Okay, I'd like to today to introduce our guests, and if you would, please stand up when I mention your names. We have, today we have Craig Ludwig. He's the person that does maintenance on the railroad, Mark Twain.
Correct.
And then we also have today Steve Degsicano. He came all the way down from Florida for us. And North Carolina. Yeah. Retake. Steve came all the way down from North Carolina to visit us. And he also is a Disney author and knows a lot about the Disneyland Railroad. You know, he's a great historian. And I hate being up on stage, but I'm breaking that.
You're doing good, Carlene.
Then we have Tim LaGailey. Where's Tim? Tim LaGailey works on a couple of the Retlaw cars, and our most beloved Retlaw car, which is the Lily Bell, which was the Grand Canyon. Him and his crew refurbished it all and did such an awesome job. And, you know, get Tim to tell you the great stories and get Tim to get you on. No pressure, Tim. Then we have the 1955 city manager that showed Walt around to find the wonderful place that we're here celebrating, Keith Murdoch. Keith Murdoch had a great relationship with Walt, and he'll tell us and share his great stories about how he found the property for Disneyland, as well as the Disneyland stories with him and Walt. And then also we have with us Paul Beauchere. Did I say it right?
Beauchamp.
Okay. Paul Beauchamp. And he also, Paul was the one that refurbished the Ward Kimball and the E.P. Ripley? No. Oh, well, we can
take
see.
Take two, that's fine.
We can see Carlene's really, you know, knows her train stuff here. Sorry about that, guys.
Brad LaRose is next, Carlene.
And we have Brad LaRose. Just come on, Brad, stand up.
I'll tell me it's coming up right here.
Well, since it's on the paper, I know now. Brad is an awesome guy. He's come all the way down from Northern California. He's also the general manager of Pacific Coast Railroad, mm-hmm. as well as he also takes people around on the old Retlaw cars. He works for a gentleman that owns all those, so he gets to deal with the old Disney cars, and even, isn't it Dr. Quinn's engine, right? So he gets a great, you know, life in working with the trains on a daily basis. And then we have our key speaker, Michael Brogy. Where is he? And yeah, everybody knows and loves Michael and knows what he does. And now it's my turn to make sure I know too, right? He's an author. He's a Disney historian. His dad also had a great relationship with Walt Disney as well as working with the railroad. And Michael was one of the first people there to enjoy the railroad as it went around for opening day and before and everything else. So... that's it, right? It was nerves.
You did good. Let's hear it for Carly. Yay! And since we are doing this as a live to tape show, let's invite Michael to sit down at his reserved table. Let's pause for a moment. Michael's coming all the way from Ontario for Railroad Show. Nice enough to come down for us. And I think we've got a nice seat here right next to everyone over there.
Come over this way, Michael.
Okay, Brian, we're going to be talking about what Steve alluded to, which is a magnificent diorama called the Grand Canyon. And Brian, if you're ready, we've got some Grand Canyon. Ready, Brian? And 3, 2, 1.
To plus his railroad, Walt decided to build a large indoor diorama depicting one of America's scenic natural wonders, the Grand Canyon. This was based in part on Walt's aptly named 1958 CinemaScope featurette, Grand Canyon. Walt assigned Imagineer Claude Coates as the art director on the diorama project. Claude was wondering why Walt wanted to place something so seemingly random along the tracks between Tomorrowland and Main Street. It didn't make sense to either Claude or his fellow Imagineer Marvin Davis. Of course, Walt had his reasons. The train ride needed a grand finale, like any good show. Claude still protested, claiming that an exhibit or show about the atom or some other futuristic concept would be better suited for this area of the journey. But Walt won out, and the project continued. The backdrop for the 306-foot-long diorama was done on the largest piece of seamless canvas in the world. It was painted under the supervision of seasoned Hollywood scenic painter Delmer Yoakum. Dell and his artist used over 300 gallons of paint in 14 colors to complete the realistic depiction of a day in the life of the Grand Canyon. Dell was an inspired choice for this job. He was famous for his paintings of desert landscapes. So that it didn't seem like a completely barren desert, the diorama was filled with stuffed taxidermy animals that are native to the Grand Canyon desert region. Unlike most of the animals of Disneyland, real or fake, these animals were never designed to move. Animals that are visible along the route include mountain goats, a cougar, pheasants, and a porcupine. Claude recalls that the worst part of the project was going down to the taxidermist to pick up the animals, smelling the stench of the embalming chemicals as well as the rotting animal carcasses. Everyone enjoying your food?
Nathan wrote that.
Walt had his Imagineer create a soundtrack for the experience on the train's PA system. As guests peered into the south rim of the Grand Canyon, they would listen to an excerpt from Fur Girofe's Grand Canyon Suite, the music used in the Grand Canyon featurette. Both the Grand Canyon diorama and the Fred Gurley were dedicated on March 31st, 1958. The Fred Gurley was the first train to pass through the diorama, with both Walt and Fred Gurley himself in the engine cab. As a unique part of the ceremony, the 96-year-old Chief Nevongnewa of the Hopi Indian Nation blessed the tunnel and the diorama in a traditional Hopi ritual before the Gurley steamed on through.
Good pronunciation on the chief's name there.
Brian. Ay, you got killer. Nevongnewa, everybody together, Nevongnewa.
Nevongnewa. That's the actual guy there. Okay, so everybody knows the Grand Canyon, and I didn't know any difference between, like, you used to go through the Grand Canyon and that was kind of it. But something happened after the Grand Canyon called the 1964 World's Fair. And during the 1964 World's Fair, you know, Walt created animatronics and kind of gave them to a different level. And that left a attraction called the Ford's Magic Skyway, which my next guest had a lot of things to do with. And basically, I'm going to bring up a Disney legend for you now, and I'd like you to put your hands together for Mr. Bob Gurr. Hi, Bob.
Well, I'm sorry that I just turned the steam off on the monorail,
right,
and
right.
I haven't been able to change into my civvies yet.
Well, we'll let you pass. It's okay.
Well, no, that's all right. I'm used to this steam because I've been having steam juice here. You give me 3 bottles of it so far. Anyway, Brian Summer, pay attention.
Yes, sir.
It is pronounced Ferdy Grofe.
See? Not, there you go. Thank you. And I didn't get to do your intro, Bob.
Hey, do an intro for Bob.
All right, let's
see. No, it's too late. I've already done it.
Wait, I've got a great one.
I want to, or you've worked on this for 3 months. Let's hear it.
At
three, two, one.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my privilege and pleasure to introduce to you an all-around great guy, fun at parties, and a terrific dancer, your friend and mine, Disney legend Bob Gurr.
Pay attention, Mr. Gaetano. The number three was not restored at the Roundhouse. It was restored at the machine shop at the Burbank Studio. This is the way.
Everybody's getting taken to school by Bob.
I was there. I remember this stuff. I don't sit there 4 later and write it. Anyway, the Fred Gurley was a very, very interesting locomotive. Those little shots where the Indians were down there, bless it. I was standing right there in the front row watching all that. If you look at the Gurley, very, very interesting locomotive. If you look closely right behind it, behind the Gurley was the Gurg. Yes, the excursion train. That's called the Gurg. I engineered the excursion train, all out of steel to look like wood. Now, in order to justify all this history, in my Wally Bogue bag, which I brought
especially from
Brazil, I came today prepared as a monorail man.
Hey, there we go. Look at this. We tried to get him a record player, but nobody had a record player.
You realize this is a 50-year-old high-tech record of the sounds of steam locomotives with the flange creaking through the
1957 record binaural audio, which is supposed to be new nowadays, but they had it in 1957 right here.
None of these technicians own a phonograph. Do you know what a phonograph is?
I called everybody. I called everyone I knew. We didn't get one. Bob emailed me yesterday about this.
He told me I had to play it on my frickin' iPod.
Hey, there's a Gurr train, right, Bob? That's an excursion
that's
train.
One. Anyway,
now, he's got something special here.
Anyway, back off. I got this Wally Bogue down in Brazil. See, that's in Brazil. Anyway, for those of you who like history, this is a document out of Disney history no one has ever seen before. And later on, if you want to come take a closer look, you can take a closer look. In the old days, starting in 1954, when the draftsman would design the locomotives and the railroad car drawings, we'd make our drawings, and then we'd walk over to a book later, and we would enter them into a book like this. And this little book has all of these drawing numbers by all of the different designers that designed the entire Disneyland Railroad. This started in July of 1954. This has all the names of all of the designers that made all of those drawings. It even has the list of the drawings of the Gurr train.
Yes, I see that.
That's in here, called the
Yeah, it says Gurr.
Yeah, Eddie Sargent, all these other guys, Ed Langenfelder, all those kind of guys.
Oh, there we go, Ed Sargent.
But anyway, and the most important thing is, where did it go? You want to know the production plan, how you engineer a locomotive. Roger Brogie takes this piece of paper, which is now yellow. There's three sheets. This is the original production plan of the part numbers, the names, and how we're going to build it. Like, you buy it out, you fabricate it, it's sheet metal, it's wood, it's a casting. That's all it took in the old days to build a railroad, a yellow piece of paper. Anyway, I'll let y'all look at this, but don't anybody attempt to steal this, because this is, there are three of these books, and I managed to get a hold of these a number of years ago, when Disney was actually throwing out their archives, and somebody said, I think your name's in one of these books, and I looked at it, and I says, oh, yeah. The guy says, well, you want them, we're going to throw them out. I said, well, okay, I'll put them with my stuff. Not letting that guy know that this was the most precious start of anything to do with the railroad
Wow, all right, Bob, thank you. Now, Bob.
Did you have a question?
I did. I brought you up here to help me tell the people all about the dinosaurs and the Magic Skyway, because that somehow, I think it's very interesting that a ride designed to promote Ford automobiles and Ford cars and people movers ended up as part of the Disneyland Railroad. And I think that's, for me, when I was a little kid, the railroad to me meant that it was the dinosaur ride. That's what I thought the railroad was. I said, I want to go on the dinosaur ride. They said, what's that? The train. And I didn't care about anything to do with the railroad other than the dinosaurs. And that was my favorite part.
Well, 10 minutes ago, you just told this audience...
yeah, something else.
...that after the Fred Gurley took the GER train
through
the dinosaurs, we built the dinosaurs for the World's Fair.
Right. Which is incorrect.
That's all backwards.
Well, yeah, that's backwards.
No.
Help set us straight. Help set us straight, Bob.
All right.
You were there. I wasn't born.
That's all right. You're just a historian trying to get this stuff right.
Exactly.
Anyway,
help us out.
We built all the four shows for the World's Fair. Mm-hmm. The idea was Walt would get everybody sponsored to pay for building all the equipment for all the four shows. At the end of that, they were all done and paid for, and Walt didn't pay a freaking penny for any of that stuff. And we brought all the stuff back. Everything came back, and it was like, where are we going to put the dinosaurs? And I think you know the story. The administration building was going to get built, and we'll put it next to the railroad track. Oh, well, we'll just put it over the railroad track. Oh, we got room for the dinosaurs. So the idea was you could put the dinosaurs in the Grand Canyon, and they never lived there. They lived in up in Montana.
Right.
But it was all right because the dinosaur set was free.
Right.
You know, we got to stick it into the railroad.
So what was going on with that? Did anybody, like, protest to Walt or say, like, there shouldn't be dinosaurs at the end of the ride? We're in Tomorrowland. At the Tomorrowland station, we go into dinosaurs? I mean, does that matter or anything?
None of that stuff made any sense anyway. People come down and says, oh, we got some kind of new deal.
Because I remember Harriet telling me that at the end of Main Street, Walt wanted to put the Matterhorn, and everyone said, well, what the heck's a Swiss Mountain doing at the end of Main Street? And he said, don't worry about it.
Well, the only guy to worry about it was the Swiss ambassador in the United States. Walt walked him up Main Street
in
59 to show him the Matterhorn. Yeah. The guy took one look at it, and he was furious. He says, it's facing the wrong way.
Oh. So nobody cared about this dinosaur
thing. No. So it's like, if we build a Matterhorn and it's twisted around 180 degrees because it looks better with that little hook part looking at Main Street, even though that's not the way it points in the real Matterhorn.
That's cool.
What's your other question?
Well, I just wanted to know, like, what was the deal? Was that just kind of a free ride that they were kind of in putting on there, or did Walt have any kind of, was there any kind of meeting, or did they just go, we're just doing this?
No, the whole idea was to get new attractions into Disneyland at an appropriate price. You do it OPM, other people's money.
Nice.
and that's what we did, you know. Lincoln came back here. Actually, Lincoln didn't come back here. We built 2.5 Lincolns. Most people don't know. And ABA, ABB, and ABC.
Hmm.
That's what we called them.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, okay. Now you know.
Okay.
Anyway, the one ran in the World's Fair for 64, 65, but how many of you know what time in 1965 there was the second Lincoln was actually working at Disneyland, which was not the one that was in the actual World's Fair? Two different Lincolns, two different shows. There was two Lincolns.
Oh, wow. Running
around.
Was it an improvement on Lincoln? Is that what the
No, they were, they're all the same folks.
Oh, okay.
Same thing. Then as far as the dinosaurs, they...
Because Walt looks pretty proud to present it there.
Well, you got to remember, in the Ford Motor Company show, if you look at your video...
Right, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That shows you, you come down this little, kind of a little time zone thing in the Ford convertibles, and all of a sudden you go into a giant room. And most people had never seen a dinosaur, you know, actually.
It was full size, yeah.
Yeah, and the, you know, the big ones that was chomping the weeds and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, it was an immense looking thing. So that made a very dramatic impression on people. So the idea was, you know, in the course, like in Fantasia, the two dinosaurs getting in a fight with the T-Rex and everything.
T-Rex and the
You know, that was a classic looking fight. So all of that made great sense that we could use that as a set
and
added
that's
to the railroad.
That's why they went to these excursion trains where he had you build. Were those taken, the old freight cars, were they taken and then turned into that?
No,
or
no, no, no.
Tell
no,
me
no.
about that.
You, Pay attention. You're going to get your history right yet.
Okay, good. This is the fun of doing the documentaries.
No, you've already learned that the authentic cars load too slow. And he's still learning how they go too slow. The idea with an excursion train was that we had used the cattle cars, railroad cars, and we modified them by taking a lot of the wood out of it so you could load it really quick. And a lot of people objected to standing in a railroad car acting as cattle. You know, we had a Russian troop come over here. They were embarrassed that we put them in a railroad car because they thought that's like cattle.
Oh, it was.
You know, but it was a great view.
Yeah.
But anyway, Walt took a big look at how it ought to be done and thought, the horse cars on Main Street load very, very easy because you just scoot right across the seats. So Walt asked me to design the excursion train where we would take the curbside posts and the castings on the end and the seat brackets and everything right off the horse car tooling, and we would make a Narragansett-style car, which is like an 1880s-style car. That's strictly a summer car. Flat floor, simple roof, and I designed it to look like wood, but it's all made out of steel. And I never designed a railroad car before, but we had a company called C.M. Lovstedt, which had catalogs of all these really nifty-looking parts. And my boss, Roger, said, well, just look in the catalog, pick out the parts you want, and draw the trucks and draw up the car. There's nothing to it. Really, there is nothing to a railroad car.
So it's just a
quite simple
Main Street trolley, basically.
Main Street trolley, a little bit wider and longer, and of course we could side-load those very, very quickly because all the seats would load at once. In other words, the time it took to do five or six people laddering, the whole train took that same time.
That was good. So that made the train go
Well, that was the clue to having a much faster load and a high-capacity car.
Right.
Because that way, we get so many people in a Narragansett compared to the record car.
And when did they go to the ones where you stand up and then you kind of move along, those kind of more excursion long benches and all that? Was that the next year? They did the different kind of cars. You know, they went did the whole Main Street trolley thing, and then they had the other kind of cars. The excursion, sideways.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay. Well, I thought you were talking about the ones that were, like, all the way up.
No. Okay. It's just like the horse car, only bigger.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Perfect. It's still there today. You just rode them. Don't you remember?
I kind of know. So we were there not too long ago.
What else do you not know?
A lot, Bob. That's why you're here.
Okay.
Hey, Bob.
All right.
Well, thank you, Bob. We appreciate it. Go see Bob's book.
Okay, Brian, you're on. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be taking a break in just a moment, but before we do, we'd like to remind you that our in-house band, the Desert Sage, has CDs available of their work. Of course, they're also available for live performances, birthdays, picnics, ice cream socials, parole revocation hearings, whatever you have going on. Sure, you bet. Okay. See any of the band members, and there you have it. We're going to be on a 10-minute break. So, ladies and gentlemen, once again, the soothing sounds of America's favorite railroad band, Desert Sage.
Welcome back. Yes, nice budget, huh? Okay, so welcome back. We're doing a little bit of a break. We got Desert Sage playing a little bit of that bluegrass honky tonk in the background. Get it done. We're gonna get going momentarily, and I'm doing a small little video cast. You're not gonna see the whole entire thing; just excerpts of it. Disney legend Bob Girl actually came up to me and said how great the sound was in his car from the last podcast I did with him at the interview and everything. So thank you, Bob, for the compliment. It was an honor, and I hope I get to do it again. Yeah.
I was just handed this note from the Lost and Found Department. If anyone misplaced a large roll of $100 bills wrapped in a red rubber band, we have excellent news. We have found the rubber band. And the band has been misplaced as well.
I thought that was a bluegrass band, not a rubber band. Well, anyway, this goes out to a certain someone. You know who you are. Sweet.
It's a very philosophical question.
Ah. Alright, I just got handed a CD from Desert Sage, actually.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would take your seats, we're going to start it up again.
I got my own copy. We're going to get going shortly, so When we come right back, we're going to continue on, and we got raffles going on here at the Golden Nugget Room here in the Holiday Inn.
At this time, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the stage and our co-director for today's event, Carlene Fee.
Well, hello, everyone. We're going to talk and share the stories about the Lily Bell and the restoration. And go ahead, Brian, start us off here.
One of the concepts thrown at Santa Fe executives eventually found its way onto the Disneyland Railroad. Following its retirement in 1966, the old passenger train Retlaw 1 was brought out every now and then for special occasions. In June of 1974, the train was officially decommissioned, written off as a relic of the past, and stored in the roundhouse, never to be used again. Or so it seemed. One of the cars received a last-minute reprieve. In July of 1974, the observation car Grand Canyon underwent a massive renovation and eventually emerged as the plush VIP parlor car, Lily Bell. Designed and decorated under the personal direction of Retlaw's president, Bill Cottrell, the Lily Bell reflected the design tastes of its namesake, Lillian Disney. Since Lily thoroughly enjoyed Victorian-era decor, the Lily Bell was decorated in this style, with deep red velvet seats, gold inlays on the wood, brass fixtures, and a custom-made floral carpet. The very first VIP guests to enjoy the Lily Bell were Japanese Emperor Hirohito and his wife, visiting for the American Bicentennial in 1976. Lily had special tickets made to board her new parlor car. They are now some of the most sought-after Disney collectibles in the world.
Okay, well, our guest speaker right now is going to be Tim LaGailey. I've also had the pleasure of writing on the Lily Bell, and I know a lot of other people have too. I also had the pleasure of going back into the roundhouse and seeing the Lily Bell when it was really being torn apart. And then as I got to see it be built to what it is now, it's just so amazing. But I guess Tim could definitely share a lot with us. So please tell us, you know, what it was like when you first saw the Lily Bell in its old condition and then tearing it apart and
starting over.
The first time I saw Lily Bell was in the roundhouse. That would have been 8 years prior to its restoration. Bill Norrod at that time was still alive and was asked by the park to make a bid on repairing it. So Bill and I went down, and Bill took a photo of me on the back end of the car in the roundhouse, which was a big no-no at that time, but we did it anyways. It wasn't in the condition it was when it finally we finally got the bid to do the job. In that 8 year period, the park had tried taking it apart and seeing what all needed to be done with the car. In that 8 years, we bid on the car 8 different times. Every time there was a budgetary year, we would bid on the car. And finally, Matt Wiemet decided it needed to be done, and we got the bid to do it.
Well, when did you actually get it in your hands? What year was that?
2005, right? Okay, so we picked it up August 18th, which is also my birthday, which was 10 years. See, I can remember all this. 10 years prior was when we picked up the Retlaw 1 cars. That's why all this makes sense to me. It was very quick. We bid on it. We got all our information together. We got the project. We picked it up August 18th, and with the stipulation that we could have it back to the park prior to Christmas. The park had was going to do all the lettering and all the furnishings inside of the car, so it had to be back 2 or 3 weeks prior to Christmas. So our deadline was very quick.
Now, I remember myself seeing it back in 2003, and it was torn apart. So did it actually stay in the roundhouse that whole time?
Yeah, it never left the roundhouse.
So for that whole 8 years that you were bidding on it, it just stayed
in there?
It
stayed at the roundhouse. We'd come look at it again, and we'd write another bid, and then the bid always changed because the scope of work always changed, but when it was basically a part by the time we got the car, so we could actually see what structurally was wrong with the car for happening.
Yeah, I hear Dale and Craig's stories all the time, so it's kind of nice. Now, you basically, it was three of you that really did the whole work, and you started it from August to...
December 7th, it went back to the park.
December 7th. And during that time...
Happiest day of my life.
During that time, did you work on it 5 days, 7 days?
It was... we started out a little slow because we felt we had a handle on the project, but a month or two into it, it became 7 days. It became 13-hour days. There were change orders from the park, that stuff they wanted done, that added to the scope, but that still didn't change the day. The day still had to be in the neighborhood of December 7th. So they were long days. I don't know how anybody else could have done it. We had, since we had already been working on the Retlaw 1 cars, a lot of the tooling, a lot of the parts we already knew how to make. We knew we had the combine car apart and back together, so we knew what it took to do that. And we knew how much labor it was going to take to do it. And we really wanted to do it for Bill, too, because it was something he wanted to do. And, you know, just, he taught us a lot.
Now, is there any kind of secret things that you could share in the process?
Not a few things. I mean, stuff that you don't see, but it's there. All the people at Disneyland that worked on the car or helped with the car signed that center panel where there used to be a mirror, where that center table is. The backside of that panel has everybody's signature from the park. My family's signatures are on one side. Russ's family's on the other. Our kids' dates are on the backside of the roof ceiling panels.
Yeah.
There was a note that we took out from underneath that center marble table when we disassembled the car that simply said, we were here in 1975. There was a full date. And we returned that note to where it came from.
That's really
so neat. There were people's signatures on the structural parts, but we couldn't tell whether that was from the original build or from when it was a part.
Now, I know I had the pleasure and the honor of riding with you on the Lily Bell. What was that like, riding that Lily Bell after it was all done? And we'll just talk about the day I got to spend.
Well, we went for Michael Broghi's dad's window dedication, and a lot of people got to ride the car. And it was fun to explain to people about the car and what work we had done on it. It's definitely a feather in our cap. And, you know, it's cool to know that you were involved.
Is there anybody that has any questions? Tony! What about you?
Yeah, I noticed when I got to ride the Lily Bell that it was really smooth. Was it using a different kind of suspension compared to the other cars?
It's on a swing bolster, which is also on some of, I think it's on the excursion cars. The big difference with the Lily Bell is everything's been freed up, and the combination of the grease and the dirt, road dirt from the track, everything gets stiff, so the car rides stiffer, but those trucks are extremely free now. They have new lubricant in them. The ride's extremely smooth. The other end of that is you have new track.
Now, you only refurbished the upper part. You didn't touch any of the lower, correct?
From the wheels all the way up.
Oh, from the wheels all the way up?
Everything. We did the trucks. We had to have the frame inspected. Everything had to be exposed with new DOSH regulations. And from that point, everything was put back together. What we could salvage from the original car, we did. What needed to be replaced was built exactly to what was there before.
Well, this is what it originally looked like. It was the Grand Canyon, which I have learned to make sure I say things right. And now I know that the Lily Bell had a plaque, but the original plaque isn't on there, is it? That's the backing that said Lily Bell, is it? Jeff's got that.
Oh, the rear, the drum head for the back is not original to the car. It's a new design.
So, yeah, it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful.
It's supposed to be a piece of stained glass in the back, too.
Right. Originally, it was a Mickey Mouse, wasn't it? Right.
Where was that?
It was in this back window of this door.
Is there any questions?
Tim, did you replace any of the sliding windows at all?
Yes, and I have a gift for you at some point.
Okay, and we have replacement needs on one of the windows is cracked. A lot of the hardware, the springs are out of the latches. And I'm guessing, you know, school kid growing up in Southern California, it looks, as the seats do, all Crown Bus Company hardware. I'm just wondering if you had any trouble finding replacements for that.
We were lucky in one fact that when we got the Red Law 1 cars, a lot of parts came with them. And along with the original seats that were in the Grand Canyon car, the two windows where that mirror was, or where the walls blanked out there, where the center table was, those two windows came with the Red Law 1 cars. Now, when we got Lily Bell, we found that two of the windows were the windows that belong in your cars. Oh. They're taller.
We're missing two.
Oh, it's not funny. So, like I said, I have a gift for you.
I'm sending the car to the shop. I'm running to rebuild. Did you get them to me?
So, we had the two original windows. We put those in Lily Bell, and we have the ones that belong in your car.
So I got a question. All the scrap stuff, the carpet or anything, where did that go?
I don't know.
eBay!
Next, there's some
we'll
of it still around.
It'll be original now.
Yeah.
Okay, great. No one.
That's original carpet?
No.
No, that's a new carpet.
I think it's the third time it's been changed.
Third time around.
Yeah. And then there's a couple pictures in here that actually came from the Red Law Foundation that were way before it got changed. And then it was an in-between shot, and then it was finally... Those chairs right there, those were the original furniture, the long seats.
Right, they were in...
Yeah, so
I'm dating myself.
I would know.
And the Naga hide's holding up very well, isn't it, Brad?
Yeah, 50 years.
Yeah, so just like gorgeous. Yeah.
It's a beautiful car. I mean, it really is such a beautiful car. And then
more Naga hides running around.
Go ahead.
Well, thinking about the Naga hide, that was done by Al Vimar, a company in East LA that built school bus seats.
Uh-huh.
And I talked to Al Demar because every time I had stopped, he picked up the upholstery of my Cadillac for no charge. He indicated that that's the Naga hide they used on school bus seats because it was indestructible.
It's amazing. It's in fact the original Grand Canyon cars seats that we have. It's perfect. I don't know what the story is.
Yeah, we hit it with the Armor All once before we have an event, and it looks brand new.
Yeah. I mean, the workmanship in those cars, and
it's
structurally, they're amazing. It was like every part was made in a jig, so every part was exactly the same as the next one. So when they went to put the cars together, everything fit.
Well, I noticed in Dale's pictures, and then seeing your cars, the seats look different color in the car that you're doing now. The seats look...
Combine?
Yeah, they didn't look like they were the same color. Was it just made
same.
The flash?
Yeah, same. Okay.
And I know if it wasn't for Craig and Dale, which were the ones that initialized everything to get done, they weren't going to refurbish the lollipop.
There's a little story behind that, and I'll tell it.
Yeah, when it's his turn. But yeah, it's been actually, for me, it's been a pleasure meeting all these guys. It really has. Right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Disneyland Roundhouse is where the... We'll start it again. The Disneyland Roundhouse is where the railroad engineers take care of the wonderful steam trains of Disneyland. Here today with us is Disneyland Railroad Engineer Craig Ludwig.
Before Carnegie gets going on this, about the Lily Bell.
It's that in the Roundhouse.
Many years. Just sitting, nothing happening with it. And they were going to take it out and just get rid of it. Luckily for us, Matt Wiemet became president of Disneyland. The first day he came to the Roundhouse, Dale Tetley and I, myself, took him back and showed him the Lily Bell in the back. He saw it and he says to me, "Wow, this is amazing." He says, "You know what, Craig? It's going to be a lot to fix this thing up. But you know what? Everything doesn't have to make money. I said, huh, that's music to my ears. So he says, and there was funny, it was like an entourage behind him. And they're all looking at me like, no, Craig, don't you didn't want to show them the Lily Bell. I said, yes, I did. And I want them to see it. They said, okay, first thing out of his mouth, he says, I want estimates. I want to see what's going to have to be done with this thing to get this thing back on the tracks where it belongs. And that's what happened. Basically, we had the in-house bids, and then Tim got it. Tim and Rusty did an unbelievable job on the Lily Bell. Just unbelievable. The only difference that you see in the Lily Bell, these pictures right here, is the only thing I left out, and I want to leave out, because when I saw the damage done because of the water and moisture in the Lily Bell, was on the ceiling there was vents, and Bob probably knows that, but there was vents, air vents on the top, and I decided to just eliminate the air vents for the weather to get in. Okay, so that's the only difference you see. When you go into Lily Bell now, you look up the ceiling, you won't see any air vents. So that was really the only difference that I had my hand in. So.
Craig and Dale are really good friends of mine, and I love them so much. And they have just done so much for everybody that loves the railroad, because if it wasn't for Craig and Dale, we wouldn't have Fullerton Railroad Days with the Disneyland Railroad, because they initiated that, and you just have two really good advocates that just really want to let everybody see the railroad as well as and enjoy it as much as they love it.
Right.
And I know also, you know, of course I get Dale, and of course Dale didn't come, but Dale called 5 o'clock in the morning and go, Carly, and he's blowing down the engine, and so we're like, oh, wait, now, you know, and he'll just share, you know, his love and his fascination for the railroad, as well as, you know, Craig is just right there behind him. And I thought it would be nice for you to also share a little bit about the roundhouse, as well as the diesel, biodiesel, and how that worked, and, you know, what engine, and how you went the steps and everything, and maybe a little bit about the Fullerton Railroad.
Right. Okay, the biodiesel program, you must have all heard about this by now. Basically, they came to us. Well, we had an idea down the road that, you know, maybe biodiesel would be the thing to keep steam engines alive at the park. I don't know if you know this or not. I had a guy from the roundhouse in Hong Kong came over to the roundhouse, and he says to me, he says, well, we're just going to take a look at the operation here. And I said, no problem. And I asked him, I said, well, what are you going to do? You're going to have steam engines over there in Hong Kong? No. You're going to have diesels? No. How about electric? No. We're going to have gasoline engines. I go, gasoline engines. Huh. What would Walt think of this? So he says, yeah, he says, that's what we're going to have. And you know what? About 2 or 3 months later, I get this call, and he says, I want to record the sounds of your steam locomotives. And the sad part was, I was the one that took him out on CK Holiday, and he recorded the sounds. So when they talked about biodiesel coming to the park, I was embracing the idea, because I don't want to see diesels. I don't want to see electric. I want to see steam. And so you hear all the bad things about diesel these days. And I thought, okay, let's try it. So we did. They brought it. We tried different percentages of it. We tried 20-80 formula, tried 40-60, went all the way up to 100% biodiesel, or B100 they called it. And basically it's 98% virgin soybean oil with 2% diesel. And the reason why is 2% diesel is because it's tax-free. But anyway, we tried it. And when I lit the engines off in the morning, I tried them off cold, I tried them off hot. And the wick would just kind of smolder a little bit, but then it finally catch, and then we throw it in, and it would be no different. The only difference in running the engines is basically the smell of French fries. That's pretty much it, you know? That
works in their favor. You
know? Yeah, so I'm sure it's up the park, too. But the only modifications we had to make to the engines at this point was the fuel hose had to be a little bit thicker, and we also have a solenoid, which had to get a different solenoid, fuel solenoid. And that was basically it. None of the gaskets, nothing else was really replaced. And it seems to be working fine. And I just hope that if they're building another park, they won't go to gas and engines, obviously. They go back to steam. And for once, we're the leader of the pack. I mean, usually we follow Walt Disney World, but maybe this time, now we've set the trend. So they all go. Now, on the Fullerton Railroad Days, great event, obviously. I don't know if you've ever been there. But we decided, well, Dale and I had a kind of input on that also, to bring one of our engines down to Fullerton Railroad Days. And to me, it was a sure thing. I mean, it was right down the street on Harbor Boulevard. I mean, it was not less than, you know, a few miles away. Why not bring one of our engines? And so people get up close, personal, and touch the engines. And ring the bell and blow the whistle, you know, and see what the engine.
Oh, and my dog was the first one ever in the CK holiday.
Okay. So we decided we campaigned to management, and management was really open arms in this, which I was appreciative. We said we want to take the E.P. Ripley. That was pretty much the one you saw to open the park. 55 with Walt. I'm not going to be corrected by Bob, but I think that's it. E.P. Ripley. Okay. Anyway, we decided to take the E.P. Ripley. And so we convinced management to do this. Management thought it over and at the last minute decided, okay, let's try it. Well, this is the first time an engine's ever left the property to be publicly displayed. They'd been worked on before outside the park, but never publicly displayed. And we're getting a little apprehensive about taking the engine down somewhere off site. So anyway, we convinced them, and we got the engine down there, and we got a truck called Lowdown, and we loaded up the thing, and Tim LaGailey was instrumental in helping us getting that done. Anyway, we got it down there, and the response was overwhelming.
It's been amazing. It really has.
So anyway, this year, we took another engine. We convinced, management really liked it, and I know Fred Camfield, I know, liked it, I'm sure, for the railroad days, and hopefully that helped us and helped the museum to come one day. Anyway, we took the CK Holiday this time, and then the interesting thing about the CK Holiday was we even convinced management to go back to pretty much the 55 colors of the CK Holiday. It was painted an orange and a black in 90, and a lot of people came up to me and said, Craig, that's not the right colors. And I said, I know it's not. But we had to convince management to repaint the locomotive, even though it didn't need painting, it wasn't fading, it wasn't chipping or anything else. We convinced management to repaint it back to 55 colors.
Which took a lot. They got that from Sean.
We did.
We took a lot. And Sean let him got the original color from under the
Russian iron blue on the jacket.
And made sure we got that back.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, we brought the engine, and I thought also, why not bring the hand car? So the hand car was completely restored, beautiful thing. Yeah. And people asked me, well, Craig, if we bring the hand car, oh, it's going to be a problem. People standing up, and maybe they'll fall off and this and that. I said, no, we need to have people up there holding the handle.
Craig, tell us about some of the great people you have met.
Oh, Carlene. Oh.
I won't mention anybody. Tell us about some of the other people besides the one that we know, you know.
Well, like who are we talking about, right?
I won't mention Ollie. Have you ever got, seriously, have you ever got to meet Ward Kimball?
Yeah, I did meet Ward Kimball at his property. Obviously a great guy. In the trains, I saw the Chloe at his property. I got to sit in the cab with Chloe. I didn't get to fire it, unfortunately. I did polish it for him up. And basically, he even signed my book, Thanks for the Polish. That's exactly what he wrote. But, yeah, he was really instrumental, obviously, in the trains.
Who's some of the other great people you've got to meet?
Well,
You got to meet Michael and you had Steve.
Yeah. Well, all you guys have been instrumental keeping trains going, you know? I went to the event with Michael's dad. It was unbelievable. That's what it's all about. Keeps us trains alive.
Our next guest is Michael Brogy, and I knew that he had grown up with Disneyland, and I've heard lots of stories, and I read some different things, but it really didn't click in my head that he actually worked with Walt on his backyard railroad at his house in Holmby Hills. It wasn't until I sat there and interviewed him and really figured out that he was part of this scene that you're seeing here from the early 50s at Walt's house of building it, that it really dawned on me that this is pretty much our closest connection to Walt's love for railroads, and a guy that got to actually sit and watch Walt make his dreams for Disneyland. So I'd like to bring Michael Brogy up to the stage now to help me tell the story of Walt's Backyard Railroad.
In June 1949, Walt and Lillian Disney purchased a piece of land located at 355 North Carrollwood Drive in the affluent Los Angeles neighborhood of Holmby Hills. Walt thought the five-acre site was perfect for both a residence and a miniature train layout. Meanwhile, Walt paid a visit to Roger Brogy, head of the Walt Disney Studios machine shop, and asked him about building a miniature steam engine. Even though Roger had no real experience with the steam trains, he told Walt that he would be willing to build the engine. Roger also employed the help of another studio machinist, Eddie Sargent, to draft the plans and help with the track layout.
So Michael, when did you first hear about this backyard railroad? And did your dad come to you and tell you he's building a little engine, or when did it first pop into your head that this was going on? Because your dad was working at the machine shop at a movie studio, which was cool enough, but now he's building a backyard mini train.
Well, first of all, I have to correct the narration.
Go ahead. Nathan's not here, so go for it.
It won't be the first time today.
No, Eddie Sargent was a draftsman.
Okay.
He wasn't a machinist.
Got it.
And so Eddie was one of the finest draftsmen. In fact, it was interesting because everything now is CAD-CAM, and he hand-drew all the engineering drawings. And I know Bob Gurr would appreciate the work that Eddie did for us. The first time I think I became cognizant of the Backyard Railroad was when my dad took my older brother Roger and me out there, and Walt was in the barn, and we walked in, and the first thing Walt did, he knew who we were because we used to go to the Christmas parties at the studio, and he handed Roger and me a couple of towels and said, go up to the tunnel, and your job is to dust down the freight cars and then bring them down into the lower level of the backyard, which Walt called Yenset Valley. So Roger and I went up there, and there were chocks that held the freight cars in the tunnel. The tunnel was 90 foot long. So we pulled the first one out, dusted it off, and we found out that there was a gravity run, and you could run from the tunnel on the tracks and wrap yourself down into the lower level. So that was a great ride, to just take and free ride freight cars one at a time out of the tunnel. So, and then we would connect them together in what railroaders called the consist. Mm-hmm. So Roger and I, at that early age, I was about 7, my brother 3 years older, we were connecting up and were deciding which order, the gondola, the freight car, the box car, cattle car, mm-hmm. and then the final crowning touch, Walt would ceremoniously bring out his yellow caboose that he kept in the barn on a special perch.
Oh, okay.
And so he hand carried it out and set it on the back, because nobody ever rode on, of course, on the caboose. You could ride on the gondolas.
And he actually hand built that. I mean, I know when you had me go out and record some stuff at the Nixon Library, and they actually lifted up the detail work on the caboose. Now he hand did all that himself. Is that correct?
That's correct. Dick Jackson, who is I consider really the father of modern life steam hobby. Dick had come to California back in around 1930 and built the first 1/12 scale steam backyard railroad, probably west of Chicago. And Dick was introduced to Walt by Ward Kimball at one of Kimball's steam-up parties. Mm-hmm. And Dick had built a 1/12 scale bobber caboose, and Walt liked the design. And Dick gave him the engineering plans to do so. And they built the frame and the truck's axle in the machine shop and then handed those off to Walt. And from there on, it was all Walt's handwork.
Wow.
And Walt loved working in miniature. And I think it was something about his own childhood. Being raised in the era that he was raised in, children worked on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to earn money outside the family, you went out and got a job.
Right.
You didn't get an allowance from dad. You went and worked for your money. And so Walt grew up in an era when they didn't have toys because they were poor.
Right.
They didn't have the money for toys. In fact, he told later that when he had a paper route that he and Roy worked on for their dad, that he would find toys in the storeroom, where children would put their toys, and he would go around and deliver paper and find toys in the storerooms of the houses, and he would sit and play with these toys of other children. And several times he'd go to sleep. He's up at 3 in the morning, he'd fall asleep playing with toys, other children's toys. And I think what we saw as an adult in Walt was that child grown up and now was working in miniature. And I think as adults what we do is we change our vocabulary. Because when you think about it, hobby is really play. They're not toys. We call them scale models. They just get a whole lot more expensive.
That is an old one. Now, the thing about Walt, too, is I noticed when I interviewed you, is you said that pretty much Walt was really feeling a lot of pressure at the studio at the time. And one of his nurses kind of said that he should go to the Chicago Railroad just kind of to get away. And the whole train thing kind of was dormant in him for a little while he was building the studio and working through all the war and everything, but really, he was in a lot of stress at this point, and the railroad was kind of a way to release it, was it not?
It was, and that was Hazel George, who was the nurse at the studio, and Walt had sustained a neck injury, hit in the back of his neck, base of his neck, by that hard ball they used in playing polo.
Okay.
And fractured vertebrae, and instead of getting routine medical attention, he went to a chiropractor that manipulated his fractured vertebrae. Oh. And so he had an injury that never healed properly, and years later, he had pains across his shoulders. In fact, you see that typical picture of Walt. He had that way of standing where he put his hands on his hips like this, and you see it many times. I know, Bob, you'd remember how Walt would always stand like that. What he was doing is taking the pressure off of that lower vertebrae at the base of his neck, because he had a chronic back problem. And it was the polo hobby. And at one time, Walt had 19 polo ponies.
Oh, wow.
And he really was heavily into it. And he was getting bruises up and down his legs. He went in for his annual medical exam with his family doctor. And he said, "For God's sakes, Walt, what are you doing?" And he said, "Well, we're playing polo every Sunday out at the Will Rogers Ranch." And he said, "You know, you're the head of the studio. You could fall off and break your neck."
Yeah.
Killed. You got to find something more, less violent and less dangerous. So he took up golf. Oh. He'd get up at 5 in the morning, go over Lakeside, and golf boredom.
Right.
And because it wasn't the kind of challenge he liked. And then Kimball invited him out to the SEMA party, and that's when he met Dick Jackson, and then started getting involved in Lionel. Mm-hmm. That whole Lionel layout up at his office.
Is that G gauge one you were talking about?
No, this is Lionel. Oh, Lionel is 43.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
1 to 43. And G is 124 or 122.5 if you're taking notes. G scale runs on the same gauge track, but it varies from 122.5 up to 1 second.
Okay.
But it all runs on the same scale track. But Lionel was the popular hobby train at the time. And years ago, he had helped Lionel survive by virtue of that license with the little hand car, Mickey Minnie hand car, and that saved Lionel. They sold 254,000 at $1 a set, including a loop of track, and it literally lifted him out of bankruptcy and survived the company.
That's why they're still here now.
Exactly. Well, there's other issues with them now, but whether they survived that, it remains to be seen. But the Lionel hobby reconnected Walt with railroading, and then when Kimball saw his interest in trains, he said, "You know, you got to come out and see Grizzly Flats." And then Ollie was introduced to Walt's interest in trains, and Ollie had 112 scale line steam running in the backyard. So when Walt went over to Ollie's, it transformed the whole realm of Walt's interest, because he had visited the live steam full size in Kimball's yard.
Right.
But here, in Ollie's hobby, it was the sights and smells and sounds of the railroad he remembers from Marceline, Missouri, his childhood, and then brings it down to that miniature scale. So now you've got all the things that Walt was interested in one hobby. And the people that were involved in the hobby were the Germans have a term called Fingerspritzen, guys with a touch that could build things. And Walt always admired people who could work with their hands, work with machinery. His father taught him carpentry, so he was a capable carpenter in his own way. But here were machinists building things that ran, and that intrigued Walt. And so he then decided he had to have one. Dick Jackson's running 112, Holly's running 112. That was the popular scale, and that is what's called patent scale. And that's where 112 came from. And maybe some of you in the audience know this background on live steam. When you created a working mechanism, you had to build a working model. You had to prove it worked to the patent office in order to get your patent granted. And so there was a cottage industry in the United States, people who would make working scale models. And they were always 112 scale.
Cool.
In fact, we have a patent model in the barn, at Walt's barn.
Is that black engine?
No.
Or is that different?
No. It's a static steam engine, a two-cylinder static steam engine. It was owned by David Rose.
Okay.
David Rose had over 300 models in his collection of steam models, and a whole set of these patent models. Well, unfortunately, but when you submitted your patent, you submitted two models, one the government got to keep, and one you took away as your own, and they were beautifully, beautifully made. The warehouse in Philadelphia, where they stored all these beautiful patent models, burned to the ground, and they lost all of these gorgeous patent models. And then the government changed its policy, and you no longer had to submit a working model of whatever it was, whatever the mechanism was. But that's where the 112th came from. Well, Walt, always thinking a little bigger than everyone else, decided he would go to 1/8 scale, which is 50% larger than Ollie's and Dick Jackson's backyard railroad. So this notched up the hobby of outdoor miniature live steam. No one had ever done 1/8 scale backyard.
Oh, okay.
So that what your narrator talked about when Walt asked my dad, would you build a railroad for the yard? And when my dad had, by then, had worked for Walt for 10 years, and if Walt says, can you do it? Your automatic answer is, oh, sure, Walt, we can do that. And then when Walt left the shop, my dad turned around to the guys and said, now what in the hell am I going to do? Because I don't know anything about live steam miniature. But Eddie Sargent, besides being a master draftsman, also was a miniature live steamer.
That's good.
And had worked for the Central Pacific Railroad. So there was great connections there. And then Jerry Best introduced Walt to the CP-173 that eventually became the Lily Bell. There's a quick story, and I know that we've been wearing on here, and people are looking at their watches. Is that working? The Lily Bell name, now of course, in honor of Lillian, mm-hmm. and the famous right-of-way agreement
right.
that Walt had the lawyer write at the studio to get the rights to run the railroad around his own yard. And many of you have heard me tell that story before. But there was an interesting story that isn't widely known about the Lily Bell name. And you think about it, there's more railroad equipment named after Lillian than anyone else, including Walt. You have the backyard, 1/8 scale, of course the VIP coach, a Lily Bell engine number 2 at Walt Disney World. And when Michael Eisner and Frank Wells came into the company in 1984, there was a rift, not least of which her son-in-law had just been fired by the Disney company, Ron Miller. So some of you that have read some of the corporate history know the intrigue going on at the time. So here is the Disney family, titular head, Ron Miller, just got fired by the company. And Mrs. Disney said, okay, everything we own comes back to the family, including all of their Oscars, all of the memorabilia, everything was pulled back. And Lillian said to one of her people that was working at Retlaw, I want the Lily Bell engine back. So, Bob Wilson called over to the studio, and they passed him through to Frank Wells, who was now the new president of the Walt Disney Company. And he said, Lillian wants the engine back. And so Frank Wells, being new to the company, says, well, where is it? It's in Florida. So Frank Wells calls down to Walt Disney World and said, I want to talk to somebody that works on the railroad, and gets a hold of a vice president there and said, do we have a locomotive down here called the Lily Bell? Yes, we do. Well, okay. Mrs. Disney wants her engine back. So the vice president then calls out to the roundhouse, George Britton, who ran the steam train operation there for 37 years and just retired. He gets a call and says, Frank Wells is ordering the Lily Bell to be shipped back to California. So George calls out to California and said, how are we supposed to get this out there? And Bob Wilson says, well, just have them crate it.
Right.
So that goes back up to Frank Wells, and so the Disney family wants the Lily Bell engine crated, and where should we ship it? And the answer is Mrs. Disney wants it delivered to 355 North Carrollwood Drive. Now, I think you're probably getting the drift here that there was a slight difference, and this goes to the fact that Frank Wells was brand new in the company. He didn't know the original Lily Bell steam engine was on display on Main Street at Walt Disney World. It wasn't the 26,000-pound mogul that was going around the park at the time. Could you imagine the crate showing up with the crane and the flatbed at North Carrollwood Drive? Said, Mrs. Disney, your engine's in the driveway.
There it is.
Well, fortunately, George got a little suspicious, and he remembered that they had the miniature on display. And so then he called out to California and says, is there any chance it's the 1/8 scale model that we should be crating up and shipping back to California? But that's an interesting story. Not many people have ever heard that.
Never heard that. I have a question. You saw Walt sometimes at the studio, right? Mm-hmm. Now, when you go out to his house on Saturday or Sunday, would he be in a different mood, or how would his demeanor be different from studio head to backyard railroad enthusiast?
Well, the interesting thing about Walt is that the personality never varied.
Okay.
He was the same down-to-earth, approachable conversationalist that you would see. At the studio, obviously, there's the pressure of the performance, doing the job and managing the company, which a lot of that he turned over to Roy. Yeah. Roy was really the guy running the business part of it. But Walt always was the creative head of the company, the storyteller, and so on. And in the days I saw him at the studio, in his office, was the same personality that I saw out at the house. Except at the house, it was the guy in the dungarees, grease under the fingernails, unshaven. And somebody asked me about this. Some of you that haven't seen me for a while, two milestones. This month, June, I become eligible for Medicare. So I thought, you know, it's time. But an actually more significant event happened just a month ago. I became a grandfather. Rather famous Brogy DNA is passing down. Now this happens to be a granddaughter.
Oh, cool.
But there's some very fine Imagineers who are women.
Oh, yeah.
So, and Kim Irvine's a good example of that. So we're hoping that the Verities right now are ahead of us. We've got three generations work for the family. My nephew Gary is head of the machine shop, as his grandfather was. Of course, my older brother Roger. And of the eight Brogies who work for Disney, six are Imagineers. My stepmother was an animator with Ward Kimball. She did all the in-between drawings for Ward. And I was the other black sheep. I became the writer. And I said, you guys build it, I'll write about it. So that was a bargain. And somebody once asked me, why didn't you become an Imagineer? And it took me a long time to figure that out. And I think it was, as a kid growing up in the Brogy family, there's always projects in the garage. And I'm a kid, 4 or 5 years old, and my dad and my brother are in the garage with beautiful precision machinery. And Gurr can appreciate this because you could eat off the floor in my dad's shop. I mean, everything was meticulous. Everything was laid out just so. It was like a surgeon at work. And my brother inherited that from my dad. He got that gene. Well, I would wander into the garage, and they're working on a project there, and I'm like 5 years old, and I'm just going to get in the way. And my dad would hand me a screwdriver, and he said, go dig in the dirt. In other words, kid, get lost. So it was, but what I was witnessing, though, was this quality of work that I figured was normal. Because I'm growing up in this family, these guys are able to tear things apart, put them back together, make them better, machine things out of stock, and make things that ran. And I'm figuring that's normal. Mm-hmm. And if you couldn't do that, you had no business ever aspiring to be a precision machinist and later an Imagineer. So that's why I never became an Imagineer. And it was interesting, years later when I went into the military, they give you this battery of exams to find out if you're a square peg or a round peg, you know, to figure out where you slot into the system. And of all the tests that they give you, all the aptitude tests, the mechanical went to the top of the scale. I had never developed it. But it was there in the genetic pattern, but I never developed it. And so I became an aspiring animator. So I used to draw, and then I later used to write. So that's more about me than anybody ever needs to know. But I think it's interesting is the influence that we have on children. And I think if there's a point in any of this, when you think about your own children, your grandchildren, what they observe us doing has great influence on what they, the people they will become. And the opportunity that I had, the blessing of being able to be around people like Roger Brogy and Walt Disney and Ward Kimball and Ollie and Bob Gurr, Bob who taught me how to drive the first Autopia car around the studio lot. And then I figured out how you could wire open the governor and you didn't shut, the governor didn't kick in. And when I went zipping by the studio, by the machine shop door, and I'm doing 30 miles an hour, and Gers says, that kid figured that out. So I did figure out a few things, Bob, that were mechanical. But the growing up of in this atmosphere, and one day I asked Walt, I said, and we were riding around the park, and I said, how did you do this? What is the magic formula for this? And he said, well, there are four words. Curiosity, confidence, courage, and consistency. He said, if you apply those four words to anything you ever want to accomplish, you will succeed. Curiosity, confidence, courage, consistency. And he said, the most important of those is confidence. You believe in it all over. And when we used to ride around the park while it was under construction on the train, interestingly, the first operating attraction, a month before the park was ready to open, the train was running around the park. And he could describe in detail what was going to happen in every area of the park. He knew every inch of that park because he was a hands-on manager. His fingerprints were all over that place.
That's awesome.
And that was the genius of Walt, is he knew the talent other people had, he knew how to drive that talent, he knew how to extend the reach beyond your grasp, and he encouraged people like a Dutch uncle. And sometimes a Dutch uncle can give you a boot in the pants when you needed it, and sometimes he could just give you a little encouragement and says, we can do this better, but there was never the direct compliment. It was always a third party. Would tell other people about what Bobby Gurr was doing. It actually, there's funny stories about Bob and Walt, because he kept calling Bobby other names because he couldn't remember his first name, right? What was the name he had for you?
Bobby.
No, but didn't he call you something else too? And you said, no, my name is Bobby. He says, well, you look like a Bill to me.
No, oh, that was
Rolling
Crump.
Oh, that was Crump. Okay, well, it's still a good story. but Walt was the kind of guy that is, and going back to your original question, is that there was no mystery about Walt. What you saw is exactly what you got. There was no phoniness about him. He wouldn't give you false praise. And a lot of people always aspired to get that praise from Walt and never. And you might have to hear about it from someone else. It's a gee, you know, that work that Bobby did on the Autopia, you know, it was great. He would never, ever say that directly.
Oh, okay. So you had to get it roundabout.
That's right. Mm. Absolutely.
Well, cool. Thank you, Michael, for coming out. We appreciate it so much. You guys. guys. We've been working on the train video for probably about 2 years. Carlene and I got involved in November of last year, starting to work on it together. And I finished it midnight on Saturday last weekend and finished the final stuff on Monday on Memorial Day. So it's 2 hours and 20 minutes. There's also two other DVDs that are coming out, the Lily Bell Restoration, a companion DVD, and a DVD of this event. So if you go on magicmakers.com website or extinctattractions.com or 8pempublishing.com, you can see it. And you can order it. Carlene will be shipping them out, so they're very fast. And the documentary is really, really nice. It's, like I said, over 2 hours. It stars everybody that you saw here today, plus Roy Disney and Art Linkletter in it as well, talking about the trains. And it's a really special DVD, and a lot of work has been going into it with Carlene and myself and everyone involved. So take a look. There's previews, and we're just going to roll the credits as the band plays. And thank you all for coming out to our second event together. Thanks very much. And thank you to Desert Sage and Brian Summer and everyone involved.
Okay, we're back with Dave O'Neill, founder of the Extinct Attractions Club and co-founder of themagicmakers.com.
How you doing, buddy?
This is number two.
This is the event number two for the Magic Makers Extinct Attractions 8-Pen Publishing Triad.
They're getting pretty big.
Yeah, we had a good turnout again today. I think we had a little over 100 folks, which is exactly what we expected, so it went well.
I learned a little bit about Walt.
Yeah, that's the whole thing with the railroad. It's like some people tell me, like, oh, you're working on the train. I don't know about the trains that much, but it's like whether or not you have an affinity for the trains or are a true train geek, you kind of learn a lot about the inside of Walt. Like, you know, when Michael was up there and I was asking him, I said, you know, pretty much Walt started this whole train deal because he was stressed out and he kind of needed a release, and playing polo and playing golf wasn't really cutting it for him. So basically the whole Disneyland started out as a stress relief.
I've always wondered what Disneyland would be like without the train.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be anything, you know.
That's
like
scary.
You'd get on it and it's like, it's weird when it doesn't operate. It's like, it seems weird or it seems silent. You know, you don't go and hear that bell or that dinging or your attention, please. You know, you don't hear that. It's something's off.
Because yeah, every time you go to Disneyland, you go on the train.
Yeah, every time. Because it's a great way
diorama,
to cut through
history.
Things.
History, the dioramas, you know.
Well, you know, even just for the purpose of just like, hey, I want to get to, you know, Small World area quick, or I want to get over to Tomorrowland. Man, you know, you can't beat the train. You get on there really quick, and it's like so nice at the end of the long day. Like, you want to get on at New Orleans Square, and you don't care if it goes all the way around, because you don't want to walk back through Adventureland and down back through Main Street. It's like,
and it's comfortable. It's quiet. You don't have to go through the people and hear like.
And, you know, like Chris
strollers.
Said, you can stay on the train as long as you want. And I think I've stayed one time during the 60-hour parties for Star Tours and Captain EO. I think my brother and I slept on the train for maybe like a six-hour period, you know, because you didn't have to leave Disneyland for 3 days. So it's like the train is a nice long bench. It's pretty quiet. And aside from the T-Rex every so often, like, you'll sleep. So the train's a good, good ride. I think if I had a baby, too, I would take him on the train, you know, and kind of like let him relax a little bit.
Get on the Lily Bell and do it there.
Yeah. Lily Bell's a really cool ride.
That's smooth.
The insider's thing that Michael told me once is if you go over there and you mention that you're a member of the Carolwood Society, they'll always let you on.
Or you can say the list.
Oh, on the list. Is that the other one that you can
that's
do?
That's the other one, too.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. But no, we had a good turnout. We had this time, you know, last time we had Wally Bogue, Bob Gurr, pretty much were our speakers. It was more of like a party, and this was more like a real, like, dedicated train historians festival, because we had everybody that's alive pretty much right now that's significant to do with the Walt Disney, with the Disney Round Railroad. I mean, Michael Broggi, and we had people like Craig, who works day-to-day on the roundhouse, and, you know, having Bob Gurr, who brought in the original plans for the railroad. I mean, this was from 1954, and he brought a little booklet that he'd saved from the trash that had all the original plans with everybody's, you know, inscriptions and how to build a railroad. And he said, you know, I'm bringing something that predates the train. And he gave me this email this morning, and I was like, what is it? And he's like, I can't tell you. And he showed me in the corner. He's like, this is it. This is how to build the Disneyland Railroad from 1954.
It's amazing what they'll just throw away.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they toss out a ton of stuff.
Destroy the monorails.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Bob's got that
big
door.
Big red.
That Bob's got that door in his house, which is just amazing. But, I mean, really, there was the guys that saved the Retlaw 1 coaches, you know, Tim LaGailey. Then there was the guy that runs the Retlaw 1 coaches
right now, Brad LaRose. It was nice to see everybody just having such a good time and just appreciating the train for what it is, and having everybody. I mean, Michael came down from over 10,000 people at a train show today to come down to our event, to our little room here in Anaheim, to the 100 people, just to speak about Walt, to teach people more. And, you know, part of Michael's heritage is growing up with Walt Disney, and he really cares enough to come out and keep talking about, you know, he might tell the same story 50,000 times, but he wants the people to know about it and wants to know why the railroad's important. And he gets choked up. You know, I was standing right next to him, and it's like I could see him welling up a little bit. If I press too hard, he'd start crying, you know.
He knows anything. You probably can't even stump him or something. He knows it.
Yeah, I mean, I was sitting by him when Carlene was doing her presentation, and someone was up there talking, and he was going, it's actually this, and you know. And it's like he doesn't have to go up there and prove that he knows everything, but he does know everything about it because he's lived through it. And
it's his lifestyle.
And he doesn't have, like, it's not just the train, it's the lessons that he learned from Walt, and it's the way that the train came together. It's not, you know, it could be, you know, antique cars. It doesn't have to be trains or anything. It's really about what he learned from Walt as a young man and how it influenced him growing up. So it's just really an amazing story.
Yeah, kind of Walt, actually, from what they know, he's always into a little bit of this and a little bit of that. He always had an interest in something.
Right. Right, exactly.
Constantly, things were changing.
But, you know, today was just amazing because it was one of those things where the last show I felt like I had to say a lot of stuff and do a lot of things, but this one I pretty much just said, and now here's so-and-so, and then they just talked, and now here's so-and-so. And this was the kind of format I like, because it's like our DVDs where I just kind of go out to the houses, interview the folks, let them talk, I just shut up, let them speak, and then every so often, like when I was with Bob, I would like throw in like, hey, what about this? And he'd be like, no, that's wrong. And I want to be told that I'm wrong because I want to get the story right. You know, I want to go.
He was
like,
funny today.
He was pretty good. I gave him a couple Jack and Coke, so he was feeling pretty good. But it was a good situation. But it's that kind of information that we're not going to get from these people unless we ask the questions. If you're ever with any of these guys and you feel timid to ask a question, like, oh, he's going to say I'm wrong, it's okay. It's okay to be wrong. Just go ahead and say, hey, is that why this? And they'll say, no, because it's more important to get the real story and have the facts there so you can actually know what went on. Because when you piece the whole thing together, I'm in a cool spot because I get to see all of the stories for all the attractions, meet all the people, and sit in the editing with all this information all the time. So I get to see, like, okay, these are the details, but the bigger picture is how the same people worked on everything and how Walt was always, like Michael said, consistent in the way that he approached things, and that's how he got these really big projects where if we started, hey, man, let's build a theme park with a railroad, mm-hmm. we don't really know how to do it. But through Walt and through his history and through the people he collected, that's how it was able to be done. So when you really get to sit back and look at the whole of what we've been doing, you get to see those secrets come out instead of like, hey, we're learning about the people mover. It's really like we're learning about how to get your dreams to reality, and that's what Walt did.
I was surprised actually to see Bob here, because I'm like, oh, what has this guy not worked on?
Yeah. Well, everybody just was so intertwined, and when you sit down with these people, I mean, I would go to like see Rolly, and I'm like, okay, we're going to go talk to Rolly about Haunted Mansion. That's all I was going to talk to him about. I mean, he talked Tiki Room, he talked Small World, I mean, he talked about all these other attractions, and I was like, wow, I did, you know, because you think about Disneyland being like, oh man, there must be millions of guys working on it, but really, there's like 10 or 12 guys that pretty much worked on everything. Like when I used to work on Friends and Sabrina the Teenage Witch and a few other shows, and we worked at a place called Modern Video Film, which did all the top shows. And it was weird because one minute I'd be working on Suddenly Susan, then I'd be working on a new Steven Spielberg pilot, then I'd be working on Profiler for NBC, and it was like, I'm working on all these shows, and people are like, you're not working on all those. And I'm like, yeah, pretty much there's like three places that do the big shows, and there's like 10 or 12 of us that work on them. You know, in any one stage, like, yeah, somebody's cutting over here, but to come and finish it, we were doing the finishing on all the top network shows. And that's how it was probably at Disney, too, where, okay, yeah, he worked on the monorail, but now he's working on, you know, the submarines. When the 1959 was going on, Bob worked on the Matterhorn, did the whole track layout, built the monorail from scratch, and worked on the submarines all at the same time within a year period. Well, about a nine-month period, three major things that are still going today and still reopening today.
And I think Autopia, too, I believe, too.
Oh, yeah, they did a whole redo on Autopia. They did the introduction of the junior Autopia, and then there was the larger Autopia after that. But there was a 1959 mark, I don't know if it was three or four at that time, but something like that. It's just weird to see how a very small amount of people influenced so many.
You actually got to be on one of the original cars.
Yeah, that was something that I really... Carlene said, we're going up to see these Retlaw trains, and I was like, oh, you know, those yellow coaches, okay. And I thought, oh, I don't know how it's going to be. And, you know, when you get on it, you're like... you kind of sit there and be like, whoa, wait a minute. This was built in the studio in 1955. This was Walt's baby. This was what he was probably looking at more than anything else was how are these trains are coming together. Aside from the engines, how are these coaches coming together? How's my guest going to experience the park? And to be able to ride around that ranch up there, it's just so amazing to sit in his actual coaches and be out in the wild.
I thought they were static, but they're actually being used. They go around that 2-point-something mile track. Oh.
It doesn't sound like a lot when you say 2-point-something miles, but the way they have it curved, like you said, they have all these grades and they have all these like S patterns, and it goes around like a little valley and then up and then by a house and all this kind of stuff. And it's really neat to ride on them because it's an experience that you don't. He doesn't just let you sit in the coaches. I mean, I don't know how it is when they have events, but like for us, we were walking on the roof. We were standing on the tender of the car. We were standing behind the steam engine. They were opening up the fire so we could look at it. Wow. We were walking on it, jumping off it while it was running, jumping back on it while it was running like a bank robber. I mean, it was so much fun. I mean, that's the kind of stuff when you think of let's ride on a train, you get to jump on. When Disneyland, sit down, don't get up till it stops. No, we're just taking all these risks, jumping car to car.
Get yourself a horse while you're up there.
It was fun, you know, and it was about 30-something degrees when it was me, Kristen, and Carlene, and we were up there and just taking pictures and laughing, and it was so cold, but as soon as we got on the train, like, we'd forgot about it being bitter cold, and our hands were blue, but we were just like, man, we're riding on trains. And it was an experience I didn't really think that I was going to be that into, and it just really, like, made me so much more interested in trains when you actually ride a real one. And this was more special because it was Walt's train. And our band today is a group called Desert Sage. They're a kind of a bluegrass group, and they do music for television, movies, and all different stuff. Our friend Jeff Remy is in the band, and also Brian Sisson, who did our event poster. These guys were also in the Agents of Voodoo, which is that tiki band, Hawaiian band. They're just so talented, and you can hear their music. This is the first time our DVDs have had original music scored for the DVDs. Desert Sage is playing all the music you'll hear in the new Disneyland Railroad DVD. Hey, you got a CD right there from Desert Sage. So yep. Those guys are cool. If you haven't logged on to extinctattractions.com and checked on our train DVD, there's a video preview up.
And the forums.
Yes. Click on the forums, sponsored by Above the Firehouse.
Tony's
website and podcast. And the forums actually also have a new section for the Extinct Attractions Radio Network, which I'm sure some of you are hearing us on the radio network right now. So thank you for listening. Tony's going to be doing a show as well.
Yep.
So
I'm putting my podcast up there in the
meantime. And we'll be doing some rebroadcasts of Tony's podcast. And in the future, we'll be doing also, in addition to the live stream, we'll also have some on-demand stuff, too, from your favorite people. So there will be, if you just want to hear, you could care less about Extinct Attractions Radio, just want to hear Tony's part, boom, just go over to the Tony side and get it on-demand and listen to it right away.
Just like that. Well, we're going to get out of here because we got to go ride the train.
Yes, so we're going to go into the sunshine and ride off into the sunset of Disneyland. And
mosey on up.
The sweet smell of the steam engines. Thanks, Tony, for coming out again and doing a show.
Thank you again.
All right, talk to you later. Bye-bye.
And that will be it, and we're going to pass it over to Brian for the final goodbye.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Extinct Attractions Club and Above the Firehouse wish to thank you for joining us at the Disneyland Railroad DVD event.